55 degrees Racine, 54 now in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a look at racism as it sometimes plays out in schools across the country. You'll hear my interview recorded with best-selling author Tiffany Jewell. In part two of today's program, we're going to be previewing the next play of the Lakeside Players in Kenosha. It is a stage adaptation of the classic film, The 39 Steps. Stay with us. Part one coming up in just a moment, right here on WGTD. I have a feeling that some of you know the name of Tiffany Jewell, who is a best-selling author several times over, the author of books like This Book is Anti-Racist or The Anti-Racist Kid. Her latest book is titled Everything I Learned About Racism, I Learned in School. This book is in many respects a hard-hitting indictment of the racism that Tiffany Jewell experienced throughout nearly all of her schooling in Syracuse, New York. But she is now looking back on that experience, in a sense, with wise eyes and understanding some of what happened to her within a wider context. And her voice is her book is a fascinating one, which is, in her own words, part memoir, part anthology, part history, part social commentary, and part something else. A really interesting book that left me really thinking about all kinds of things that I tend to take for granted. I think it's an important book for many people to read. It's published by Versify, a division of HarperCollins, again titled Everything I Learned About Racism, I Learned in School. Tiffany Jewell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited that I can talk with you. I think one thing that's really important right off the bat is to talk about who you were, or maybe the whole matter of labels and how you were labeled. And obviously, it was important to you because it's one of the first things you go into in your book. You talk about being light-skinned, black, biracial, cisgender, female, and yet when it came to filling out forms for a school, there was no box that checked all of that off, and right. so there were very right. sort of simple labels. Explain how you tended to be labeled, because I think that has a whole lot to do about what you experienced and what you saw in school.
For sure. So growing up, my sister and I have a twin sister, and we are light skinned. Our dad's black, our mom's white, like many other kids in the United States. We lived in a single parent home with our white mom. And it wasn't until we were juniors or seniors in high school that we found out that our school labeled us as white. All throughout my own knowledge and stuff, I've always known I'm biracial, maybe just called it something else, mixed. and known like that I am white and black and a whole person, but our school, someone somewhere in the district labeled us white and probably did the same for other biracial kids, other kids of the global majority living with white folks. We don't know the extent of that, but it had a huge impact, I think, on how our schools looked at us and how they treated us and the opportunities and advantages we got, because I share in the book, like, I was tracked into the we call it Team One, but it was like the track that was like, you were college bound, whether you know it or not, you're going to go to college. And a lot of my darker skinned peers were not tracked in the same way when we went to middle school. And, you know, I was a hard worker and I got good grades. And so did like all of my classmates. We were all hard workers and got good grades and all of that. And so just like, you know, the book is a lot of reflection on me understanding my identity in different parts of my life, but also the way that schooling kind of pushed us in one direction or another.
Right. And so what's so intriguing is that this is a book by a black woman, but in a sense not telling the black story that we maybe expect you to be telling us from the title of the book. Mm-hmm. That in fact what you are writing about as much as anything is how unfairly other students were treated versus the way you were treated, the privilege that you were extended simply because the box marked W was checked off in terms of mm-hmm. who you were. So it seems to me that you're in a position to write this book and to tell this story from a fairly rare perspective, even though what you ultimately are talking about is something experienced by all kinds of people all the time.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I have so many contributors to the book, because I was like, this can't just be my story, because my story is other folks have similar stories to me, but it's also unique. And so if I can have other voices in this book, then my hope is that every reader will see themselves in this story somewhere.
And that is a really valuable aspect of the book. And I've heard you say in another interview, I don't want to write books by myself anymore. and I appreciate that there are other voices here, and I'm going to highlight a couple of them in just a moment. One of the things that's probably important for us to know about your experience in public schools in Syracuse, New York, is when it occurred, and the fact that, in your words, I was part of the ongoing desegregation experiment in our city schools. Explain the state of desegregation at that point in time and the way in which ultimately desegregation or integration was not handled very well at all in Syracuse and in lots of other places as well.
Yeah, I think the thing that's so unique about, or not unique about this story, is that like it takes place in Syracuse, New York, which is a mid-sized city in central New York, and like this kind of thing happened like not just in New York State, but like so many different other parts of the country, in particular, I think like the Midwest and the Northeast. We always learned that segregation was like a Southern thing. And that it was, you know, solved in 1954 with Brown versus the Board of Education, and kind of like thinking that in upstate New York, we're like, we're fine. We've got it. We've been like, you know, integrating well before like Brown versus the Board of Education. And so that was like the story we'd kind of been told, the story we felt. But when I was doing research for the book, And really looking at where our city was. I went to school in the like early 1980s. I think I started school in 1984. And I started when I was three as a preschooler. And so I went to school in the 1980s and graduated from high school in 1999 and college in 2003. And so you'd think in the 80s, like 30, 30 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, you'd be like, okay, we're doing okay. But really, you know, looking at the way the city tried to handle integration, there were so many missteps, as we see in states and cities across the country. And a part of that was the New York State Department of Education, like, had this rule that you couldn't have less than 15% or more than 45% Black students. And it was, like, always about, like, Black and white, too. And so with that, like, no school was supposed to have a majority of Black students and families, which just, like, astounds me and incredibly unfair and unjust, especially when we look at how neighborhoods are and were created because of redlining. And so our schools, like, were unbalanced according to the state. The school that I went to had about 52% Black students, so we were unbalanced. The school district tried to do integration by having, like, first, you know, volunteer busing, and that didn't work. And then by shutting down schools, and the schools they shut down were the ones that were predominantly Black. Like, there was a school up near the Syracuse University that was, like, almost all Black with a Black principal, Black teachers, incredible. And they shut that down, and those kids were bused to different schools. And then they started the magnet school movement. Magnet schools were pretty much created to really solve the problem of segregated schools and work on integrating. So I realized, like, my school that I went to was a fairly new magnet school, and we were, in fact, like, a part of the experiment in the city to, you know, the next wave of, like, hoping that they can integrate schools and meet those New York State mandates.
Right. You write at one point about how school integration seemed to never address root causes of the divide. They were looking mm-hmm. for quick fixes, and of course those always proved to be elusive. I think one thing that is important right. about your book that also, I mean, as one looks at the title, one might not realize, you know, what a rich array of perspectives are part of it. I'm reminded of the opening words of a really interesting essay that you include from a writer by the name of James Byrd. He opens his essay with these words: "What I've learned about racism is that it doesn't always come at you swinging fists and spitting out slurs. It's not always violent and loud. Sometimes racism comes at you smiling." And I think he's, you know, he goes on to tell a story where I think we understand where he's coming from. But I mean, I really think that that's part of what your book is about, is that this is not about overt hatred. I mean, racism sort of cloaked in that, where it's unmistakable, but that racism is sometimes born out of genuine concern, even kindness, but also from terrible misunderstanding about, you know, what's needed and what's really fair and so on. And I appreciate the fact that you go into depth and into some of the complexity of the various kinds of racism that you experienced during your schooling, both, you know, the deeply personal from individuals as well as systemic racism. I mean, you really try to tell that whole story.
Thank you for sharing. I love James's piece too. When he shared it with me, I was so excited to read it because it was a perspective that was totally different from mine, but also, like, yeah, one that I totally got and understand. You know, how many times have we sat in classrooms or gone to banks or places where people have smiled at us and then, like, denied our rights? Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Right. One of the things you say in your book is that third grade was a real turning point for you in terms of the way that you understood your school and your schooling. Explain what happened in third grade that changed things so dramatically for you.
Yeah. I wrote about this a little bit in my first book, too. I had a teacher who she lived in the suburbs, and her kids went to the, like, well-funded suburban school. And she was the kind of teacher I had great teachers, but she was not a great teacher. And she just says, like, she said things that were, like, very overtly biased and racist. I remember going home one day and telling my mom something she said, and my mom was just like, what? And the way that she treated students, like, it was very clear and obvious to me the way she treated darker students and black and brown students. You know, deny, like, you can't go to the bathroom, even though, like, it's, like, your right to go to the bathroom, and what she said. And so having her as a teacher and walking into the classroom every day and being like, she's still here, was one of those moments where I was like, this is, system isn't, like, really made for us. And this is coming from, like, I had an incredible second grade teacher who kept us close. She loved us. She trusted us. Like, we felt it. We knew it. Into a classroom with a teacher who just, you could feel that she didn't care about us and that she was scared of us and that she didn't know what to do with us. And that, you know, third grade is also the year that we started taking tests, like statewide tests. And so that's also the year that you learn that you're measuring up or you're not measuring up to other kids in the state. And other kids in well-funded schools. And so, you know, I think it was like the following year we learned that our school was considered like a failing school from the test scores. And that, like, also, you know, we're like, how can we do well on tests when we don't even feel safe in our classrooms? So that was like one of those moments that, you know, and then talking with my mom about it, like, she reflected back to me, like, you know, like, you liked school, but you did not like that experience in third grade.
When you share with us a vision of how things could be profoundly better, fundamentally better, one of the things that I think you say so eloquently is the need to, in a sense, include everyone and everyone's story in what is taught and what is shared in schools. At one point you write this, we need not just to see ourselves in the books we read, we need to know that we were limitless. We needed our voices, our thoughts, our creativity, and our joy to be welcomed. And I think that was a really eye-opening moment for me as someone who's white male, you know, privileged in so many ways. I don't know that I've ever really stopped to think about, let's call it, the plight of a young student who doesn't feel any of that, who feels when they are sitting in a classroom like this is all about someone else's life, someone else's world, someone else's reality. What would be one or two of the ways in which schools could do a better job of doing what you were just spelling out here?
Yeah. This is a question I ask kids whenever I work in a lot of schools too, and was recently talking to high schoolers and asked them, like, you know, what's something you wish you had that you didn't have or don't have at school? And so many of them, no matter like who they are, where they're from, like white kids, indigenous kids, like all different kinds of kids will tell me, like, they want more time in school to understand who they are. They want to be able to explore their identities and learn about other people's identities. And they also want to, like, have time where they can ask questions and it not be shut down because, like, there's not enough time or because the teacher doesn't know, like, to have time to do that exploration. And that's, like, across the board. Like, I wish I had that in school. And I went to school, you know, like, I graduated in 1989. That was not that long ago, but it is not recent. And kids today are wanting the same thing that I wanted back then. And so there's something, like, we can do this. It's like, we can really easily give kids and students that time and space if we, like, kind of reassess what is important and, you know, taking tests and isn't as important as, like, knowing who you are and the people around you are.
Right. I appreciate the time you take to talk about terminology. And you mentioned a couple of ones that I think are especially important. One is to stop talking about the achievement gap and start talking about the opportunity gap instead. And the other thing, you've already mentioned it or used it once in this interview, and that's the idea that that you are not part of a minority, but you are part of the global majority. Maybe pick one or the other and explain why that shift in terminology can really make a difference in helping us understand each other a whole lot better.
Yeah, I'll talk about minority a little bit because I think, like, for folks who aren't in education, like, this will, like, meet them too. But I, you know, like, I was always called a minority. You know, they're like the minority population. And that's always referring to Black, Indigenous, people of color. And it felt really demeaning to be considered a minority, to be called, like, you're less than. You're literally, like, less than who the majority is in the country. But I heard the term people of the global majority years ago from a colleague who worked with Dr. Barbara J. Love, who does a lot of work around anti-racism and liberation. And I know other folks have used it too. And people of the global majority felt so empowering when I heard it. And it was one of those phrases that kind of like put a light bulb, like, hey, you know, like maybe in my college classroom, I was like the only person of color, but in the world, like there are whole continents where folks are Black and brown. And we continually discount that because of our like colonial mindset in this country. And so people of the global majority feels like is a reminder of like we are a collection of people around the world who can like amplify each other and uplift each other, and you never have to feel like you're less than because you're not. And so I think it's a really beautiful term.
I do too. I really, really loved your book. It gave me a lot to think about, and there are nearly 20 other writers whose work is represented in this book called Everything I Learned About Racism I Learned in School, published by VersaFi, a division of HarperCollins, the author Tiffany Jewell. Tiffany Jewell, thank you for this book, and thank you for this privilege to speak with you today. Thank you so much, and best wishes.
You're welcome. Yeah, thank you so much.
Listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two will be coming up in just a moment. And for part two of today's program here on WGTD, we're going to be previewing the next play of the Lakeside Players of Kenosha. And it is a play called The 39 Steps. And The 39 Steps has been around a long time, first as a novel, then as a classic Alfred Hitchcock film, and now in this comic parody of the film. And we have two gentlemen joining us in the studios today who are part of this production. First of all, Steve Mattner, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Correct.
Is the director of this production, and Sean Collier is the leading man, if you will, in the cast of, I believe, four actors who are part of the, I'm seeing five, actually. So anyway, we're going to be hearing all about, first of all, this intriguing story and the way in which this story has been, in a sense, turned on its head in this parody version, which has been around for a few years. First of all, we welcome both of you to the morning show. Glad you found us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So, first of all, Steve Mattner, we're speaking with you on the morning show for the first time today. Maybe tell us a little bit about your own background as in theater and in directing, and what things you've done with the Lakeside Players ahead of this production of The 39 Steps.
I've been around Lakeside Players since 1990. You know, started building sets, worked my way up as extra on the set of hands, and went to acting in shows and took some acting classes and became more involved and was asked to direct, and here I am today.
Wow. So is this the first thing you've directed for Lakeside Players?
No, I've directed many shows.
Tell us just a few of them.
Well, I'll Be Back Before Midnight was my first one, and it was a thriller, and then I moved on to comedies, and I just stick with comedies, so.
So you're a funny man, then.
I try to be.
He knows where his bread is buttered.
Comedy does sell, doesn't it, in the
it
world
does.
Of community theater.
It does.
Sean Collier, let's get a little background from you as well in terms of your background in theater in general, and in particular, then, your connection with the Lakeside Players.
Okay, well, I'll make the story short. I'm a recent transplant to the Kenosha area from Southern California. Came here about a year and a half ago. Did quite a bit of theater in school back there, but then took a break. Got back into it after 10 years. Took another 10-year break. When I moved here, went to see my first show at the Rhodey, at the Rose Theater, and it was The Addams Family. Nearly 2 years ago, and thought it was a really good time, and thought, well, you know, I'm here now. I really do miss getting on the stage. I should, you know, maybe think about trying something. So they had a flyer in the theater for, you know, if you want to audition, here's the email address. So I got on the mailing list, auditioned for a show last year called And Then There Were None. And it was, you know, a good way of getting my feet wet. And that went up at the Rhodey exactly a year ago.
Hmm.
So it was a good way to get back and transition back into the one true passion of my life, and decided to audition for this show. I was really pressed into auditioning for it by my co-star. I'll give her credit, Erin Tedor. She thought I'd be great for it, and read the play before auditioning and thought, oh, man, there is so much potential here. This show could be absolutely fantastic. And I was really excited to audition for it, and I guess it went well.
Evidently, because here you are in the leading role of Richard, is it Haney? Is that how we pronounce
Haney.
It? Haney.
Yeah.
Richard Haney.
Yeah.
Before we get into the plot, Steve Mattner, tell us how specifically you were given the assignment to direct this particular production. I mean, did you seek out this particular opportunity, or is it just kind of luck of the draw that this is the play you're directing?
Lakeside Players has their 50th year this year, and I want to be involved, and I looked at the slate. There was a few musicals on there. I'm not qualified there. And then I looked at the other shows and said, oh, I saw the 39 Steps at Bradford, enjoyed it a lot. I saw it at Drury Lane and enjoyed it again, and here I am.
There you go.
Okay.
All right, so it is time to kind of untangle the interesting story. First of all, well, there's two interesting stories, it seems to me. One of them is the plot of the 39 steps, but also kind of what I alluded to very briefly in the introduction, namely that the 39 steps itself is kind of complicated in terms of first being a novel, then being a film, then being this parody of the film. So all these different versions. So maybe one of you can sort out that first thing and the other can sort out the actual story of the 39 steps. So whoever wants to do it.
I'll let you sort out the origin because I hope you're more qualified than I am.
The origin of... Well, it was adapted from the movies, and I watched there was a movie before the Alfred Hitchcock version, and I watched that and said, wow, I can see a lot of that movie in the plot of the script of for the play. And you can, I mean, there's 35 scenes to this show, which is a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, and especially with just five actors, it's a lot of ground to cover. I found the humor between the lines, and I just had to get down to it and start thinking it out. And I've seen it twice, so I've seen what they've done with it, and I've had actors read the script and go, that's not very funny, and you really do need to just look between the lines for the humor.
So it's not pie in the face kind of humor.
No,
not at all. So, Sean Collier, let's have you sort out for us kind of the, at least the basic outlines of this complicated plot.
Well, the basic story, you know, I kind of want to preface. It's funny that, you know, I was rolling up to the theater for rehearsal the other day, and on the marquee it says Alfred Hitchcock's 39 Steps, which, okay, fine, but I hope people aren't coming expecting to see some kind of serious ultra thriller noir spy extravaganza, because this is an absolute ball. It is a fun time. It is a over-the-top comedy. It is a true farce in the sense. It is wild. I mean, you have three actors essentially playing how many characters, Steve? Like 80-something characters?
Well, that's what they say. I think
it's an exaggeration.
30,
like 30 characters. But you're not meant to be fooled into thinking. You're in on the joke as an audience member. I mean, sometimes it's as subtle as a switch of a hat and a slight change of an accent to show they're now somebody entirely different. But the plot centers on a British patriot who has just come back home to London after being away in Canada for about, well, we don't really know how long, but he's been back home for about 3 months, and he's bored. Mm. His life is now, it's just at a stage where there's nothing much exciting for him to do. He's in his late 30s. It's a boring life for him. He's fed up with his existence, and he's hoping for something exciting to happen, which, you know, you be careful what you wish for. You might get it.
Yeah.
Case of wrong place, wrong time puts him on the path of being falsely accused of murder and having to clear his name and prevent a conspiracy from the Nazis to take over England, you know, obviously ahead of the actual timeline. But every time he steps up to the challenge, he's knocked back down. It's like a complete roller coaster ride of a life for him in this, you know, this 2-hour play. Every time he thinks he's on top of his game, he's flat on his face. He's not really the hero for our time. He's the hero we need, not the hero we deserve.
Right. So he's somebody who's kind of placed in sort of dire peril, but not the standard heroic type who knows what to do.
Absolutely not. He is no Indiana Jones.
Right, right.
He is no James Bond.
So this is who you are playing. So unlike some of your castmates,
yes,
who have to take on multiple roles, you are Mr. Hannay,
oh, yes,
start to finish.
Oh, I am. And I am so lucky. I watch them do their quick changes, and I just think, oh, boy, no, thank you.
Well, yeah.
Did have to do it for the last show I was in, and quick changes, they can be rough, and I don't envy any of my fellow cast members because they've gotten it down so well. I mean, some of them have quick changes that are, you know, seconds. Seconds they have to completely change their costume.
And we'll talk with director Steve Mattner in a moment about that, because I'm sure as director you had a whole lot to do with sorting out all of those logistics. Sean, tell us a little bit more about your character, his personality, the way he sort of carries himself. I mean, and what is maybe fun about playing him?
Well, I think he considers himself a gentleman, but at times he can be, sort of short-sighted and selfish. He does try to do the right thing throughout the show, and sometimes it's the right thing in any given moment, but maybe not the right thing for the total overarching story. It's an incredibly fun character to play. I was telling Steve this week that this is honestly the most fun I've had working on a show in as long as at least 20 years. I can't wait to come to rehearsal every night and put on these shoes of this crazy character, working on accents, posturing and posing. And it's a role in which I really get to use my entire instrument. Like, it's a very, very physical role, and I'm trying to use everything from my eyebrows to my toes, if you know what I mean.
So, yeah. When I was going to ask you if, because it sounds like kind of also a high energy, almost Marx Brothers kind of comedy.
Yes.
And so I wondered to what extent this involves physical comedy on your part.
To be honest, every day I go home and have to wring out my clothes. It's very physical, a lot of hard work, but I wouldn't change it for the world. Yeah.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today with two gentlemen who are part of the Lakeside Players production of the comedy, The 39 Steps. The 39 Steps was originally a novel published, I think, back in 1915, and then transformed into a couple of different films, most famously by Alfred Hitchcock in 1935. But what is being presented at the Rohde Center for the Arts this coming weekend is actually a comic parody of the film, which was penned back in 1995, and then, I understand, rewritten about 10 years later. Are you doing the 1995 version or the rewritten version of the 39 Steps?
Oh, good question, because I did not ask that. The board chose that, and I just took the script for what it was. I didn't look that up.
No problem. So Sean was referring to the fact that I assume everybody else in the cast, aside from Sean, is playing multiple characters.
Yes.
Tell us more about that, kind of the specifics of that, and also the complicated challenge of that for them and for you as the director.
Well, the challenge for the actors was slowing everything down. They start out mixed up like everybody else because it's just so quick, and it's sometimes like Sean said, a change of a hat and an accent, and then they go right back on, which is in itself a job. But they have caught on to the rhythm, and we brought in a dialect coach from Parkside, and we are working with the actors to streamline it and get it so that they can get it down, and they have done that, and I think we're about ready to go here. So
so each of these actors then is responsible for how many different characters, and does the script very much specify that this particular actor is responsible for these particular parts, or are you as director free to kind of assign those as you see fit?
Well, there was in the script it calls for two clowns, and it says clown one, clown two in front of each of the lines. We added an extra clown, Holly DeYoung, because logistics of the stage for us and pulling it off, and we wanted everybody to have time. And she came in and took over a few of the roles, and then she's very much involved in the stage crew. And we've done it that way.
I think you should mention, though, just not to interrupt, but they're called clowns. Like, that's their title, the character title. I don't know why. Wouldn't want anybody showing up thinking anybody looks like Bozo. Okay, there's no actual clowns. I'm afraid of clowns. I might not have auditioned if they were clowns. Because, that's just what the characters are called.
Exactly. And we divvied it up equally that way, and They all caught on, and they are doing a great job.
One of our actors plays three different love interests, all to Hene. So and it's literally just a change of accent, costume, and wig, but she's doing a fantastic job. Sometimes I will call her by the wrong name in rehearsals because it's very hard to keep three different women straight who all look very much alike.
Right. Well, that brings up the interesting point of, for the audience, how is it that they keep track of who's who? And when a given actor takes the stage, is the script written in such a way that it's always clear who's playing who?
To an extent, yes. But then the part of the fun is no. Because, well, I'd say for, obviously for myself, no costume change, maybe a different jacket. So you're always going to know who I am. Great.
Right.
And then for Erin, she's three very different costumes, very different wigs, very different accents. It's very easy to tell. Now, for the other three, the clowns, it's sometimes very, very – it's meant to be very subtle, tongue-in-cheek, and funny. You're literally supposed to see somebody turn their back, put on a new hat, turn their face to the audience, and they're a new character. So the audience is completely in on the joke. You're not meant to think, oh, that's a completely different person that appeared out of nowhere. That's part of the fun.
Right.
Yeah.
So the impersonation is not meant to be convincing in
the conventional sense
of the word. Yeah. So how would you characterize the comedy of this play? I mean, what in it is funny, or in what way is it funny?
The situations, it's very funny, situational comedy. There's quite a bit of physicality, so there is, you know, I'd say there's a little slapstick going on. I'd say there's some...
Everything.
Yeah, everything. I mean, there's some highbrow jokes in there. There's everything from, you know, if you're into Steve Martin or if you're into Jackass, I think there's something in there for you.
Interesting. So, Steve Mattner, what have been some of the biggest challenges for you as the director of this production? And we're speaking live Tuesday morning, so you have your last couple of rehearsals still in front of you. But, I mean, looking back and also looking ahead, what have been kind of the stiffest challenges of taking on this particular play?
Well, I have to say that I do have a co-director, my wife, Clara Tappa, and we've kind of split up the duties. I try to bring in the funny, and she takes care of the serious stuff, and then
logistics.
We gel.
Logistics, too.
Logistics, yes. I just like finding the funny in the situation, and she figures out where they need to be, and now she's on the job of getting the lighting and the sound crew on cue, and then our daughter came home from school, and she has streamlined a couple of scenes from us because she has a degree in theater, and she is doing a great job. She streamlined us, so we had to give her a title in the program too.
Oh, good, she deserves it.
What do you mean streamlined?
Well, we had some blocking that moved from left to right and right to left, and she came in and watched it, and she's like, well, why don't we just do it here instead of going dark and moving every, you know, the furniture, and it worked out well for us. She did a couple of other things, and the actors caught on real quick, and I think it helped them, and it moves the story along quicker.
Great. So creating a little more flow between scenes and
yes.
So on. We've already mentioned the fact that this is really directly a parody of the 1935 Alfred Hitchcock film that maybe some of our listeners have seen. I know I have not. I'm curious, Steve Mattner, did you make a point of having your cast watch either the Hitchcock version or the other film version that you mentioned, or did you think that was not a good idea for whatever reason?
We didn't ask them to, but I think most of them have watched a version of the movie, and I don't think they needed to watch that because we're doing a comedy, but the movies, like I said, I watched the version before Alfred Hitchcock, and I could see where somebody adapting this play could pull the stuff from and find the funny, and hopefully we did the same.
Yeah. Sean Collier, have you watched the Alfred Hitchcock film? And if so, did that prove helpful to you in any way?
Long answer, no. Short answer, no. Honestly, I didn't think it would help my performance. I'll be honest, I try to avoid watching when I'm doing a show or whatever, I try to avoid watching representations of my character until it's over. Because I don't want to subconsciously steal or mimic or copy. I really try to make something my own, and you know, sometimes that's for better or for worse, but I really want to make it my own. And I didn't really think that the Hitchcock version of, I mean, that Hene was ultra serious. You know, he's a desperate man in a very desperate situation who's never trying to make anyone laugh. So I didn't really.
Quite the opposite, actually. Wow. Well, it certainly sounds intriguing. And again, this is a comedy parody of the Alfred Hitchcock classic film treatment of The 39 Steps. And it's going to be opening this weekend at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha, and running for how many weekends?
2 weekends.
For 2 weekends. And if people want tickets, can you give them advice on what to do?
I'm sure they could get them at the door, or they could order them at rohdecenter.org.
What's the, yeah, the website is rohdecenter.org. That's R-H-O-D-E center.org.
Great.
Get tickets there.
And I know the phone number once upon a time was 657-PLAY. I don't remember if that's still the phone number or not, but I've announced that so many times over the years that I believe that might be the number. But at any rate,
I haven't gone. I remember that number, but I don't think I've used it in many years.
Right. Well, maybe that's not it. But anyway, then Rohde Center for the Arts, you can certainly go to the website and get all of the information that you need. And also tickets will be available on sale at the door to come and enjoy The 39 Steps with Sean Collier in the lead and in the director's chair, Steve Mattner. Gentlemen, I appreciate both of you joining me today on the morning show during what I know is a really, really busy week. And we hope that you and your cast and crew all have a wonderful and successful run of performances of The 39 Steps. In fact, we should really say cast and crew, because I know with complicated comedies, the crew is just as essential as the cast in terms of making it all go.
Absolutely. They're all lifesavers. Every single person there is a member of a team. We are all a core group. It's, you know, Steve and I live and die by what everybody else there does. So it's a huge team effort.
Yes. Well, best wishes to you and all of the team for The 39 Steps at the Lakeside Players, and best wishes with all of these upcoming performances.
All right.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to speaking with Dr. Herschel Kruger, who is on the theater faculty at Carthage College. And he's going to be here with several of his theater students to talk about their next production, which is On the Verge by Eric Overmeyer. On Thursday, a big day here, Kaylin Palomares is going to be joining us. She is on the staff.